Support for WVIK comes from Kathleen Collins at the Dragonfly in Bettendorf. Using both conventional and alternative counseling methods for empowerment to help create change for individuals and couples. More information is at KathleenCollinsCounseling.com.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Welcome to the opening edition of The Best of Heartland Politics, my radio show and podcast that has aired since 2014. I'm Robin Johnson, and I've taped more than 300 interviews over the years with guests ranging from presidential candidates to political operatives to pundits. Some of my better-known guests have been Joe Biden, our current president, Donald Trump, our previous president, Hillary Clinton, and Tom Brokaw from NBC News. Most of my favorite guests, though, have been authors and other keen observers of American culture. I believe culture is a major influence on our politics, and to understand culture goes a long ways to understanding our politics. The first of my favorite shows is a great example of that. In 2016, I interviewed the author of the definitive biography of Frank Sinatra. His name's James Kaplan. James wrote two books on Sinatra's life, more than 1,600 pages, and I read every one of them. The focus of the interview was Sinatra's interesting political evolution from New Deal Democrat to Reagan Republican. The stories along the way, from his relationship with Jack Kennedy to his mob ties, track how our country was changing over those years. Some of the anecdotes shared by Kaplan are riveting, especially Sinatra's reaction to not hosting JFK before the 1960 Democratic Convention. Of course, I couldn't talk Sinatra without asking Kaplan to share some of his favorite music from the chairman of the board. So listeners will get a chance to hear some of the top picks of songs by the author of the definitive biography of Sinatra. I hope you'll enjoy this interview, Robin Johnson with James Kaplan, on The Best of Heartland Politics. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talking Politics. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and today, after several months of nonstop focus on the Iowa caucuses and conversations with presidential candidates and pundits, we're going to shift gears to something I think and hope that will be fun and a little different. We're going to mix the worlds of entertainment and politics by exploring a recent biography of Frank Sinatra with the author, James Kaplan. James, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today.
It's my pleasure, Robin. Thanks for having me.
Now, this was the second of two books that came out. The first was called The Voice. It came out in 2010. And then this latest one came out last year, was called The Chairman. I got it as a Christmas gift and read it and really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
And this is really a great book. It's a biography of one of the greatest singers of all time in this country, but it intersects with a lot of different areas, including politics. And that's why I thought it would be interesting for our listeners. Take us back, James, if you would, to Frank Sinatra's upbringing. And he was born into a pretty political family, wasn't he?
Well, that's one way of putting it. His mother was extremely political. His father was not a very important figure in the family or in Frank Sinatra's life. But Dolly Sinatra, Frank's mother, was a powerhouse, and she was an ardent political Democrat, big D Democrat, and very active in Democratic politics in Hudson County, New Jersey, in Hoboken and Jersey City.
So he was brought up, and she was. This was during a time leading up to the New Deal, correct?
Yeah, I mean, when Franklin Delano Roosevelt was elected in 1932, Sinatra was just about to turn 17, and these were formative years for him, and his politics were very much the same as his mother's politics. FDR was a hero in that household, although his image got dinged a little bit at the beginning of World War II when there was a lot of suspicion about Italian Americans then. But he was a big hero in that family.
Now he grew up. Sinatra grew up and got into singing and entertaining. But he actually, as you said, the family, especially his mother, and he adored FDR. And he actually got a chance to meet Roosevelt at some point.
He did. It was well into, let's see, I believe it was in the, FDR was campaigning for his fourth term. Mm-hmm. He wasn't feeling very good. He was pretty worn out at that point. But it was in 1944, and Frank Sinatra used to frequent a bar in New York called Toots Shores. Toots Shores was a famous crossroads of the world, or I should say of the masculine world. It was always filled with entertainers, prize fighters, all kinds of colorful characters, and Sinatra was one of the most colorful. Toots Shore cultivated all these characters. One of the other characters that frequented Toots Shores was the Democratic National Committee chairman, Robert Hannigan. And Hannigan knew that FDR was feeling tired. The war had really worn him down. And Hannigan told Shore that he was welcome to come to tea at the White House if he didn't mind a bit of a crowd, 20 people or so. And Shore decided to bring along Frank Sinatra. And so, in the White House's Red Room, there was FDR himself, and Frank Sinatra got to meet his idol.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing at a young age to meet your political hero at that time.
It was a little deflating, actually, that meeting. FDR took a look at Sinatra, who was very, very skinny. In those days, skinny and short guy. And FDR turned to his secretary, Marvin McIntyre, and he said, Mac, imagine this guy making them swoon. He would never have made them swoon in our day, right?
So that I'm interested in your opinion that you go into in the book, in a political socialization process, all of us go through this. A lot of us tend to adopt the political outlook of our parents.
Yes.
I certainly did. And he did, obviously, out of his devotion to his mother and following what she did. And she was very active in Democratic politics. But he actually was a strong believer in the New Deal and helping people. Correct?
He was, and he was a great. He was extremely charitable his entire life. He had great. I think because of his upbringing as an Italian American in an America of the 1920s and 1930s, where Italian Americans were only a half a rung up the social ladder from African Americans, and were really kind of condescended to. I think Frank always had a strong feeling for minorities. He certainly was a great advocate of tolerance, and as soon as he started singing, he began frequenting West 52nd Street in Manhattan, which in those days between Fifth Avenue and Sixth Avenue was an entire block full of jazz clubs. And you could walk down that block and go into these clubs and hear these great geniuses like Lester Young, Count Basie, Duke Ellington, and Billie Holiday, and Sinatra did, and he idolized them. He saw that these musicians carried themselves like royalty, and that they were geniuses, and he knew instantly how ridiculous racial prejudice was. He stuck with this his whole life, even as his politics in his middle age veered toward the right.
Now, during the 1950s, it's kind of a quiet time for him politically. We had, of course, Truman took over after Roosevelt's death, and then Eisenhower came in, reflecting more of the conservative times of the 50s. And he also was starting to attract some attention from law enforcement as well. Can you describe that period and how he really wasn't as active politically, but yet as he got involved with some different characters, he started to raise his profile a little bit in not necessarily a good way?
Well, his profile, that's putting it mildly. this country turned very conservative after World War II, and with the rise of the right wing, Republican politics, and especially the rise of and a lot of fear, and a lot of it justified, a lot of it legitimate fear of Soviet Russia and of communism worldwide. The country became very conservative, and Sinatra, who was ardently liberal and unapologetically and vociferously liberal, was called out for it in a lot of conservative newspapers. Unfortunately, he was called out for other things as well. In 1947, he was spotted at a mafia convention in Havana, Cuba, and a columnist for the Hearst papers, which were very right-wing, began writing about Sinatra's links to the mob, and Sinatra did himself no favors when he began to fool around with a lot of beautiful movie stars, especially Ava Gardner. And so the newspapers really took out after him. I think the conservative papers did not like him as a liberal to begin with, but once he began visibly hanging out with these criminal characters and visibly stepping out on his wife and his young children, he became catnip, unfortunately, for a lot of the columnists, a lot of the national columnists. I don't think that it's true that Sinatra's political feelings were quiescent during the 1950s. I think that he was as passionate as ever about democratic politics, but he was also, until his comeback began in 1954, he was under a lot of pressure, a lot of financial pressure, a lot of public relations pressure, and a lot of personal pressure. So once his comeback began, I think that he began to feel his oats in a number of ways. Professionally, he signed with Capitol Records, began turning out these great albums with Nelson Riddle. He began making a lot of movies after he won his Oscar for From Here to Eternity, and he was visibly and ardently a political Democrat. In fact, he was asked to sing the Democratic March, a song that went to the tune of Yellow Rose of Texas, at the 1956 Democratic Convention. And that was the convention where Edley Stevenson, where there was a lot of jostling for the running mate for Edley Stevenson, and for about 10 minutes, it looked as though John F. Kennedy might become the candidate for Stevenson's running mate. It turned to Estes Kefauver instead, and that's a whole story in itself. But in fact, Sinatra had met JFK the year before, at a Democratic fundraiser in Los Angeles. So I would say that Frank's politics were still very much on his sleeve through the early and middle and late 50s, especially more and more in Kennedy's camp in the late 50s.
That's a great segue. And the next topic is the Sinatra-JFK relationship. You talk about how, in some ways, people described it as a mutually beneficial relationship. Talk about that a little bit as far as how they first met and really were kind of attracted to each other.
Yes. Well, I would call it more than that. I would call it in the most heterosexual possible way. It was love at first sight. These guys fell for each other. Kennedy was a much cooler cat, however. He was a cooler character than Sinatra. But since his young manhood, he had loved Hollywood. Jack Kennedy loved Hollywood. He loved beautiful women. He loved beautiful movie stars. His father, Joe Kennedy, had bought into RKO Studios, and so they had entree, they had cachet in Hollywood, the Kennedys did, and he was, after World War II, here he was, this rich, handsome war hero, and he cut quite a swath through the ladies of Hollywood. When he met Sinatra at this Democratic fundraiser in Los Angeles in 1955, Sinatra at that point was the biggest name in show business. His comeback was in full swing. He was making all these records, record albums, and big singles, and shooting all these movies. And his relationship with Ava Gardner was basically over at this point, and so he was getting around a good deal. Frank was, and Kennedy thought that was That was great. He wanted some of that. He wanted to be close to Sinatra's magnetism, if we can put it that way. Sinatra, for his part, his valet once said, "Mr. S craved class like a junkie craves the needle." And Frank saw in Jack Kennedy the ultimate in class. Not only a war hero, not only a Boston Brahmin, not only a Harvard graduate, but witty, articulate, and filled with charisma. And as Frank saw it, a surefire presidential candidate, and very likely an upcoming president. And so from 1956, from the moment Jack Kennedy lost that vice presidential slot to Keith Olver, his presidential campaign began the next day, really. And Frank Sinatra was right on board.
You're listening to Talking Politics. This is Robin Johnson of KBRM 1490, Burlington, Iowa. We're talking today with author James Kaplan, who's written an excellent biography of Frank Sinatra in two volumes, The Voice, which came out in 2010, and The Chairman, which just came out last year. We're talking about the Sinatra-Jack Kennedy relationship. And Frank really felt, in your book, in a couple passages there, he really felt quite close to the inner circle. You mentioned that there was talk of him getting an ambassadorship to Italy, and then another reference was there was a key meeting at the Democratic Convention in 1960, and somebody reported that Sinatra was tending bar at this meeting. So it was pretty close, at least he thought it was, right?
Well, it was pretty close, but it began getting dicey almost as soon as it got close in 1960. The problem was that Jack Kennedy, he was a bad boy in many ways, and he was, although he had the press, the nation's press on his side and protecting him as far as his extracurricular activities were concerned, his family saw Sinatra as a bad influence. His family saw Jack Kennedy hanging around with Frank in Las Vegas at the Sands and keeping company with a lot of various kinds of women, not all of them the girl next door, and the family didn't like it. This guy was running for president. They wanted him spotless, and Sinatra had a reputation. He had a reputation of hanging around the wrong sorts of people, mobsters, and of generally being a fast-moving showbiz type. Jack Kennedy was prescient in his understanding of show business's power in political campaigns, but at the same time, the family thought Sinatra was a bad influence and began to distance itself markedly from Sinatra during that campaign. It was a little schizophrenic. Frank, in fact, once Jack Kennedy was elected, Frank organized this enormous inaugural gala, a show of 100 stars in Washington, D.C., and it was a great triumph for Frank. But virtually from that moment on, from January 1961 on, his star began to fall as far as the Kennedys were concerned. And that indirectly and slowly, gradually, and then all of a sudden led to Frank's turning right politically.
I couldn't help but wonder if Joe Kennedy would not have had that debilitating stroke, that Frank might have been able to stay a little longer into the inner circle. Do you think there's anything to that? Or
I'm not sure that's the case. I know that Bobby Kennedy was extremely anti-Sinatra, and he was, as we know, a very important part of his brother's cabinet. Of course, Joe Kennedy was kind of the puppet master in many ways, but Joe Kennedy has had his misgivings about Sinatra as well, and he knew that Frank had mob friends. Joe Kennedy, made use of these mob friends through Sinatra in helping Jack Kennedy get elected, but he worried about the association. So I'm not sure that's the case.
You mentioned Bobby Kennedy tried to keep Jack distanced from Sinatra. Jackie Kennedy didn't care for him as well. There's also this disturbing triangle, or whatever you want to call it, between Sinatra, Judith Campbell, Sam Giancana, and Kennedy, which really, looking back on it, it really just...
It's astonishing.
Recklessness. Recklessness is the word.
The president of the United States should be sleeping with a woman who is also sleeping with the head of the Chicago mob. J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI, found out about it. He let Bobby Kennedy know, and that was the last straw, really, as far as the Kennedys and Sinatra were concerned, because Sinatra had made the introduction. Sinatra had introduced Judith Campbell to Jack Kennedy. Sinatra had introduced Judith Campbell to Sam Giancana, the head of the Chicago mob. And it was really, it was a triangle with Kennedy, Giancana, and Judith Campbell, but it was in a weird way sort of a rectangle as well, because Sinatra was there too. But Bobby Kennedy put his foot down. At that point, he was attorney general and said, you can no longer associate with that guy.
Two stories I've got to interject here. And what I like about the book is you do talk about a lot of these little stories that have been passed down, whether true or false, and you explore them and give both sides. The first one is the accusation that the mob helped Kennedy carry West Virginia in the 1960 primaries. That was a very key primary at the time against Hubert Humphrey.
It was a key primary, and I think there's a certain I think that there are two parts to the story of the mob being asked to help Kennedy. One part has to do with the West Virginia primary in 1960, and the other part has to do with the election itself and the northern precincts of Chicago and environs. I think the latter story has more truth to it. I think that Richard Daley, also the mayor of Chicago and not unfamiliar with the mob himself, had a lot to do with helping Kennedy get over the top in the election. As far as the West Virginia primary was concerned, there were a lot of – it was a remarkable thing because there you had an extremely Protestant state, and you had a Catholic candidate for president, and by nature inimical to those voters, but somehow Kennedy wins the primary, and he beats Hubert Humphrey and dashes Humphrey's hopes for that election. I think there may have been some funny business. I don't think the mob had as much to do with it as they had to do with election returns in northern Illinois.
The other story has to do with when Sinatra was told that Jack Kennedy would not be staying at his place in California, he'd be staying with Bing Crosby. Instead, he went out and took a sledgehammer to a helipad.
Kennedy had stayed at Sinatra's Palm Springs place a couple of times, and particularly the year before, 1959, when he was campaigning, there was a pretty wild party there. And the president, we're now in March of 1962, was looking forward to a return engagement. Jackie Kennedy was traveling in India. The cat was away, so the mice were ready to play. Jack Kennedy was looking forward to going back to Sinatra's Palm Springs place and having some sun and fun, mainly fun, probably indoor fun. And that was exactly the moment when J. Edgar Hoover told the Attorney General, Bobby Kennedy, that the president and Sam Giancana were sharing a lady friend and that the president may not stay at Frank Sinatra's house. Jack Kennedy was cool. He was a pragmatist, and he didn't flinch. He switched his accommodations to Bing Crosby's place across the valley from Sinatra's place in Palm Springs, and it was a huge public slap in the face. It was Sinatra's hair trigger. He had a violent temper, and the hair trigger with him was always any whiff of humiliation. This was a gigantic humiliation, and he had prepared, he had remodeled his house extensively, the compound extensively. There were all kinds of, and yes, he had put in a brand new concrete helipad, and yes, in his fury, he ripped out the hotline he had installed for the president. He threw pictures against. He went nuts, and he took a sledgehammer out and impotently tried to smash that new concrete helipad.
So moving on after the, of course, the tragedy of JFK's assassination, Sinatra and LBJ had kind of a mutual dislike, which you talk about, but then Frank kind of wanted back in the political game and he agreed to help Hubert Humphrey. How did that work out?
Well, at first it was okay. At first, Humphrey was a guy who liked everybody, and he was very charmed and very flattered that Sinatra wanted back in. He loved Washington politics. To him, was very sexy. That was a kind of power he wanted to be near, and so he wanted to be close to that presidential campaign in 1968. And at first, he and Humphrey got along swimmingly. But very quickly, it soured. It soured because Humphrey's advisors whispered in his ear that Frank Sinatra had certain associations, that their candidate might not want to be associated with. And so, basically, Humphrey dropped him. And 1968 was a very bad year in this country. It's a very turbulent year. The Democratic Convention in Chicago, the uprising there, the assassinations of Dr. King and then of Bobby Kennedy. And Sinatra had turned 50 a couple of years before. He was middle-aged. All the political unrest made him frightened. And he began to feel more conservative. The dropping by Hubert Humphrey made him feel more conservative still, and then when a guy who had been closely associated with Frank Sinatra's arch enemy Bobby Kennedy, a guy named Jesse Unruh, threw his hat into the ring for the governorship of California, Sinatra decided to support his opponent, Unruh's opponent, Ronald Reagan.
And he had said, made some awful statements about Reagan and Reagan.
He thought Reagan was a boob. Sinatra had been around Hollywood since 1943, and Reagan was roughly the same vintage. They came up at the same time. Sinatra was around when Reagan was making Bedtime for Bonzo and movies like that, and he thought that Reagan was a bozo. However, suddenly, feeling more conservative and a little more worried about the country in 1968 and then 1969, 1970. 1970, Reagan is running for governor, and he's suddenly looking pretty good to Frank Sinatra.
So he goes from a New Deal Democrat to endorsing Reagan's reelection in California in 1970.
And all the while insisting that he's still a Democrat. His Democratic friends were outraged. They signed a petition. They sent him letters. They were putting ads in newspapers. Frank, don't do this. And Sinatra he felt that he could, the pun is unavoidable, that he could do it his way, and that he should do it his way, and that he would do it his way, that he could be a registered Democrat and still support the man he felt he wanted to be governor of California, Ronald Reagan. Well, it was, he didn't stay a Democrat for long.
And then he supported Richard Nixon's reelection in 1970 and winds up appearing at one of Reagan's inaugurations, correct?
Yeah, in 72, he supports Nixon again, very quickly comes to regret it. He had made friends with Nixon. He had made friends with Nixon. Sinatra retired for about 10 minutes in 1971. And it was a little more than 10 minutes. It was a few months. But he was asked to entertain at Nixon's White House. Since he was by now a Republican, he went. And he did the gig, even though he's officially retired. And Nixon said to him, you really ought to You ought to unretire. You ought to get back in the business. You're too good to stay away. Well, that was music to Sinatra's ears. And so he made friends. He made nice with Richard Nixon. Yes, supported his reelection campaign in 72. And again, once Watergate hit, very quickly came to regret it. But yes, when Reagan ran for president, Sinatra was right there, and he organized a second inaugural gala, Ronald Reagan's inaugural gala in 1983.
So was this changing? I mean, we've read about in politics the Reagan Democrats. Was Frank's transformation from New Dealer to supporting Reagan, was it based on principle or opportunism or payback or some combination of the three?
No, I think that he felt it was principle. I think that... But let's not forget also that Sinatra had one side of his parentage was Sicilian. He had a great sense of vendetta. If you crossed Frank, you crossed him forever. So Bobby Kennedy, although Frank never held it against Jack Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy had crossed him, and he held this against the Kennedys and against the Democratic Party. I think that and once you were his friend, you were his friend forever. And so he became friends with Spiro Agnew, who, although he was blatantly a crook and then was convicted, that was nothing to Sinatra. He was convinced that Spiro Agnew was a good guy. And so he stayed friends with Agnew. And I think the connection with Reagan was one of principle, some opportunism because he wanted to be close to power. That had a lot to do with it. But he had become conservative. He was, by the time Reagan took office, Frank was now in his 60s, and he was feeling more conservative.
I'll put you on the spot here and ask, since you are as familiar with Frank Sinatra as anybody, who do you have any idea who he might support among today's presidential candidates?
That is a rough one. It's really a rough question.
Okay, two or three.
Two or three. Yeah, Frank was a very smart guy. Frank was a very smart guy, and I don't think that he would have liked Trump. I think that he might have admired Trump's panache, but I think he would have felt that Trump was a political know-nothing ultimately, and didn't have the goods politically. And so who would he have set his sights on in the Republican Party? I think he would have had a very rough time of it this year, because he was not only smart and knew politics, but he had a keen sense of electability and of charisma. And so in Ted Cruz, for example, I don't think that Frank would have cottoned to him much. I don't think he would have liked him very much. I certainly don't see him supporting Bernie Sanders, and I see him having misgivings, great misgivings about Hillary Clinton because of the various skeletons in the closet there. It's a very rough question, and if I had to pick one, I don't know if I could pick one. Hillary Clinton is maybe the closest I could come, simply because I could see Frank Sinatra having been friends with Bill Clinton. I could see Frank Sinatra liking Bill Clinton's charisma, liking even his politics, his kind of centrist bent, even though he was a Democrat. And I could see him returning to the Clintons with reservations.
Or maybe his hometown governor, Chris Christie.
Don't think so.
Okay. Two more questions. Both of these are not political, but I got to ask them because I'm sure a lot of our listeners would want me to. The Godfather story, the first Godfather movie kind of plays off on the idea of Frank Sinatra's character in the movie supposedly has mob ties that then get him this role in this movie. And that's supposedly the theory has always been that that's Frank Sinatra being portrayed there. You talk about that in the book. Share with our listeners how you approach?
Well, there are two parts to the myth in Mario Puzo's book about Johnny Fontaine, the Sinatra-like singer. The first part has to do with Johnny Fontaine's being released from his big band contract with the big band leader, who was very similar to Tommy Dorsey, for whose band Frank Sinatra sang in the late 1930s and early 1940s. In fact, Frank Sinatra did have a northern New Jersey godfather, a man named Willie Moretti, and I think Willie Moretti did put a certain amount of discreet pressure on Tommy Dorsey. I think there may have been a menacing phone call. But the reality is that there was no gun put to Dorsey's head. Nobody said to him, either your brains or your signature are going to be on this release. The real story of Frank's getting out of that band had a lot more to do with lawyers, a lot more boring than the myth in The Godfather. Part two is even juicier. So Johnny Fontaine wants this movie role. The producer says, no way, no how, are you going to get it? And Johnny Fontaine goes to his godfather, can you help me? And a horse's head, the beloved, prized racehorse of this movie producer winds up in the producer's bed, and the producer knows that Johnny Fontaine's godfather means business, and he has to give him the role. Nothing like this happened. Frank Sinatra got the role, and from here to eternity, largely through Ava Gardner, to whom he was married at the time. Sinatra's career at that point had gone down the tubes for all the reasons I told you before. His music and movie career disappeared after World War II, and Ava Gardner's career was on the upswing. She was getting sick of him. She was getting sick of her new husband. He was moping around. He was broke. And she went to the head of Columbia Pictures, Harry Cohn, and told Harry Cohn that if Harry Cohn gave Frank Sinatra a screen test for From Here to Eternity, that she would give him a free movie. Harry Cohn was reputed widely to be the biggest lecher in Hollywood. He looked Ava Gardner up and down, and he gave Frank Sinatra the screen test.
not as intriguing as the movie. Yeah. Final question, and this one's tougher than who you think Sinatra would support for president. But as somebody who loves his music, one music lover to another, what would be your favorite? And I'll give you 3 to 5 Sinatra songs.
Oh, I get 3 to 5?
Yeah, I couldn't give you just one unless you want to do that.
That's easy. Okay, so I've got to pick one from the Columbia years. It's before his downfall and before he went to Capitol Records. I'm gonna pluck out You Go to My Head, just a beautiful rendition of that great song by Sinatra in his Columbia years. At the beginning of Frank's Capitol years, I'm going to pick I've Got You Under My Skin, an irresistible smash hit and glorious rendition of Cole Porter's great song. A little later on, I would pick Sinatra starts his own record label in 1960 called Reprise, and his first album is called Ring a Ding Ding. I would pick that wonderful song by Sammy Kahn, Jimmy Van Heusen as number 3. Is that 3 or 4?
That's 3.
That's 3. Okay. And I'm going to pick the fourth and final one from the amazing, beautiful, tender, magnificent, quiet album that Sinatra made with Antonio Carlos Jobim. The song is spelled, D-I-N-D-I. It is pronounced Brazilian Portuguese. It's pronounced Gingy. And it is a glorious rendition of a glorious Jobim song by Frank Sinatra.
James, one more thing. You have a website where people could go to learn more about the book and about you?
Yes, please. JamesKaplan.net. Easy as pie. Last name Kaplan.
Again, for our listeners, I highly recommend this book. It's not just, again, biography. It's history. It's politics. It's entertainment. Music. If you like music, this book is – I really enjoyed it. I'm going to read it again sometime. And James, I'm very, very thankful. Appreciate you coming on our show today.
I had a lot of fun, Robin. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.